So you run 4 miles, which feels eminently doable, but you do it every 4 hours and you do it for 48 hours. So the challenge is sleep deprivation and the mental side of it when you get towards the end because you're not really able to sleep properly.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO, co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Andy Meller from summit17.co.uk. And Andy is a fractional CFO. And today we're going to talk about something controversial. When my uncle, who was a managing partner of PricewaterhouseCoopers in Portugal, heard that I was interviewing fractional CFOs, he said, you know what? So they're just people who couldn't get a real job. You know, they were in a big corporate company. Eventually they got moved on and now they have to say they're doing something. And we're going to talk a little bit about the stigma between that has developed around the word fractional CFO. We're going to face it head on. And we're going to help you, if you're listening to this, figure out the difference between someone who's just calling themselves that versus someone who has the goods to back it up. And we're going to chat about what that is. And we're also going to talk about how maybe if you are a fractional CFO, you can build equity for yourself as well as just selling hours. I'm going to do that with Andy. Andy, thank you very much for coming along today. Before we get started, maybe you could tell us something about you that not many people know.
Sure. Thanks for having me, James. Yeah, something that people don't know. I guess maybe I have run ultramarathons in the past. I've done the David Goggins challenge where you run 48 miles over 48 hours doing 4 miles every 4 hours. That was an interesting one. Currently injured and training to come back and do some more in the future.
The David Goggins thing, did you do that by yourself or was it a group of crazy people?
It was actually in lockdown and there was a couple of us doing it sort of remotely and we joined together to do the last couple of runs. So yeah, it's an interesting one.
Yeah, he's totally crazy. There's a guy called Jesse Itzler who wrote a book called Living with a Seal and it's about how he lived with David Goggins. David Goggins, if you don't know, is an absolute nut, exercise fanatic, ex-Navy SEAL. He's just a crazy guy. Look him up if you haven't seen him. He'll get you motivated to do some exercise. And how'd you do? So explain it a bit more. So it's how far and how many hours? How did you orchestrate it?
So you run 4 miles, which feels eminently doable, but you do it every 4 hours and you do it for 48 hours. So the challenge is sleep deprivation and the mental side of it when you get towards the end because you're not really able to sleep properly.
Sounds like torture. And do you think is there any parallel between that sort of torture and working as a fractional CFO, working in finance in general, do you think there's a personality trait that's attracted to both?
Yeah, I think we definitely have compulsive, obsessive tendencies, and that's probably one. I think planning, if we're gonna kind of draw a parallel, doing all your planning, creating some spreadsheets for the plan, for training for it, or if you're doing long runs, training for kind of nutrition and rest and all that kind of stuff. So I think, yeah, there's definitely some parallels in there.
Very good. Okay, well, I'll give a shout out to Billy, our controller bookkeeper, who's an ultramarathoner as well. So maybe there's a trend here I'm spotting. So let's get into this because we have some interesting things to talk about. But let's start off with your background. How did you get into your position as being a fractional CFO for a number of clients? How did you come up in the profession? Let's put it that way.
So I started my life in a fairly big corporate in the co-op. Came out of my A-levels, did all my training there, gained 2 accountancy qualifications, then moved into kind of growing businesses. So a pharmacy business that was kind of growing very quickly, did a few years there, then did a gym business where we did an MBO with a private equity firm, then went to another growing business that was private equity backed again, a nursery business, and then a couple of privately owned and a startup business that was kind of through COVID. And then moved into being a fractional CFO or a portfolio FD, as it was known back then, about 3-4 years ago. And yeah, since then, been growing the portfolio and now very happily full to bursting from a client point of view.
So what's been your biggest sort of a commercial success or defining moment in your career so far?
I'd say getting to where the business is now that I'm running, that feels like kind of done really well. I really love what I do, being able to kind of offer that level of expertise to SMEs. I would say the thing that kind of, from a working in corporate point of view, probably the MBO in the gym chain was a, I guess you could say, career defining because of the experience that it gave in, you know, working in a business that was growing, had been through some troubles in the past, getting it through a financial due diligence process, raising finance, all that kind of stuff was like, yeah, it was loads of experience gained through that period.
Yeah, okay. So this is one of probably the, we were talking beforehand about what's the difference between, you know, just someone, a finance guy who's out of work and a real fractional CFO, because it's a bit of a controversy these days. It costs nothing to change your LinkedIn to fractional, whatever you want to be. I could be a fractional programmer, I guess, if I wanted to. But I guess having gone through something like an MBO, like your bookkeeper is never going to organize an MBO for you, right? But probably you need a fractional CFO. Or that's probably maybe a good question. If you're hiring a fractional CFO, ask them what sort of PE or MBO experience they may have. So tell us a bit more about that. What did you learn? So gym chains are kind of scalable. There's a guy I follow online called Alex Hormozi. He's famous for selling a chain of gyms early on and learning to scale them and so on. So what was the backstory? What was going on with this gym and why did they need an MBO in the first place?
Yeah, so that was, it was a big, they were big gym sites, which is slightly different to the kind of the smaller gyms that are doing the scaling thing or have been for a good few years now. Yeah, so it had gone through some troubles, had some kind of very high rents, had gone through administration, had come through that. And then we'd come in kind of a couple of years post administration and it was starting to get back on its feet, it was growing. So our job was kind of just really optimizing that cost base to grow the revenue and the EBITDA to get it to a point where we thought we could do an MBO deal. So yeah, that happened and continued to do really well. Yeah, took that investment, invested in the business.
And when you say you went in, was this part of a PE team that you were going in to run this and then, or what was
it? Effectively, it was a kind of a turnaround team. So there was kind of four of us that came in around the same sort of time, a couple of guys who were really good at the turnaround thing. Myself and the CEO came in within a few months of each other and then, yeah, all worked together to make that happen.
What I'm curious about a turnaround team. So what do you think? It's kind of curious to me, like you have people who are running the business. You'd think they would be the most qualified to run it. And yet you have a turnaround team that can come in and make a difference. The stereotype in my mind is that they just cut and slash and they fire the people that the other team was too wimpy to do. Is there truth to that? Or what would you say makes a turnaround team successful? Why could they succeed when the original team couldn't?
Yeah, I think they were really experienced guys and had a really good balance of controlling costs, optimizing cash, but equally investing in the right places to get the business to grow at the same time. Because it was on the other side of the troubled period. They'd done a really cracking job to get the boat stabilized at the point where we came in to then help them kind of really grow and optimize the business.
Okay. So you've got how many clients today and what's your ambition? Like, where do you want to bring that to? How big or small do you want to make this business you've built for yourself?
Yeah, so five businesses that I work with at the moment, ranging from kind of day a week to a couple of days a month. Currently just starting to work with some associates to kind of widen that portfolio out to be able to offer what we do to more people. And also launching an arm that we're doing financial modeling for people looking for funding and for private equity businesses to kind of really improve their financial modeling and management reporting.
Okay, and the modeling part, would that be more like a project piece? So someone comes with a startup idea or maybe an existing business they want to expand and it's like a project piece to do your fundraising and then move on?
Yeah, effectively, it can be a one and done where we build you a model to be able to get the funding. We're keen to kind of make that into build models that are usable on a day-to-day basis going forward that you can either work with us. It might naturally bring you into the fractional finance piece as well, that, you know, you can get somebody that goes through the fundraise but then needs the monthly reporting to be able to report to the funders or the equity house. So yeah, there's a natural flow, or there's a kind of a one-off project.
Okay, so I'll be honest. My experience of models is when I hear people talk about models, I hear about a model they've been working on and it's going to be great and there's a lot of work goes into it and I can see it. And then eventually one day an Excel sheet is presented with, oh, bewildering array of cross tables and pivot tables and references and all this sort of stuff. And normally the person who's built the model is super excited about it and into it, because I get that. I'm a programmer, so I understand that sort of nerd itch, let's put it that way. But then you're like, oh my God, how am I supposed to actually use this? Like, it just feels like a bit of a toy that only one person can use. So how do you avoid your model just ending up just as that on the shelf somewhere, never looked at again? Do you have any, is it just an Excel sheet, or do you deliver more than that when you're making a model?
I think it's like MNS. It's not just a spreadsheet. So yeah, I think the key to that is having, I guess, sections of that model that are appropriate for the right users. So if you've got an owner CEO, having somewhere where they know where they're going to go to get the information that they need, and they don't need to worry about all the sheets in the background. They've got data tables, and they'll have data tables, and they should be linked to your accounting system and all that kind of stuff. They should have that, and that should be kind of really well structured and everything, but they should never need to go there, and they shouldn't need to worry about it. I think the thing about making it somewhere that you are not apprehensive about going into is really important, that you can make the whole thing integrated into the business. And if it's got all the right information in there, and it's dashboards, and there's kind of really useful monthly reporting versus targets and all that kind of stuff, you can create this model that is integrated into the business that becomes the go-to for making decisions, understanding what's going on in the business, seeing how people are getting on against their targets. By definition, that then forces the model to be up to date and accurate because people are using it, and it doesn't then sit on a shelf, wither on the vine, whatever you want to call it, that it almost forces the people who own the model, the FD and the finance team, to keep it up to date, because they know people are going to be going to it and looking into it for the answers to the questions and the decisions that they want to make.
And so of the times that you've deployed a model or built a model for someone, what percentage of time does it actually wind up getting used that way?
Well, in all my clients, I can say it's used in that way. We are constantly refreshing the model, using it to look forward, as well as looking at the historics and letting it report on the actuals, using that to create rolling forecasts, keeping our eye on what's the future EBITDA looking as a metric, how we perform against it. There's always occasions where you build one and somebody doesn't quite use it like you imagined they were going to use it. And if it's an ongoing client, will help them understand and educate them into the way of using the model to make it more integrated into the business. There's not a lot you can do about that with somebody if it's a one and done, but they decide to not use it in the way it was designed to be used. It does feel a little bit sad in those occasions.
Okay. All right. Well, I was going to do this later, but let's bring it up here since we have our first ever listener question from Colin Hewitt. He's the CEO at Float, and he has a rather self-serving question here, which he sent in, which is 100% fine. There's nothing wrong with that. So the question for Andy, he's wanted to send for you, is, can you talk about the difference between a 13-week and a traditional monthly cash flow, and ask him if he has found a good solution for that, which I think is the most leading question I've heard so far. It's the only one we've had, they're pretty leading. Yeah, just tell us a bit about how you work with Colin's solution, and how does that fit into the models that you build?
Yeah, okay. So yeah, Colin, for those that don't know, runs cash flow forecasting. I am a big fan of it. I use it in all my day-to-day clients. So that's a short-term cash flow forecasting system. Looks from the two ways of looking at that are direct cash flow, receipts and payments, looking at the ins and outs, all that kind of stuff. And the other version would be what we would have in one of our financial models, which would be an indirect cash flow, which more looks at kind of longer term cash flow, working capital movements, looking at how kind of profit converts to cash and what does that leave you for servicing debt and that kind of thing. So yeah, there's a big difference between the two. I think the 13-week cash flow is very detailed and would be kind of, your numbers are all kind of, they'll all be very obvious to a non-accountant. I think they'll be surfaced in a way that makes sense. You'll see your invoices coming in, your bills going out, your HMRC payments going out, your loan payments, for example. And it'll be things that you would recognize from your bank statement, and is very useful if you've got the detail behind it. From an indirect point of view, it will give you your month-end balances. It won't be looking on a day-to-day and a weekly basis. it will kind of give you all your look forwards, and it will all be based on the budgets and the forecast that you've created. The way we use it is effectively we create the forecast model first, given us the monthly numbers. And I think it makes sense to have, I guess, there's a bit of an airlock between the two. So we create that budget forecast for the next 12 months. We then take that and convert it with all the P&L and all the various kind of other cash payments that might be sitting in your balance sheet, like corporation tax, PAYE, and loan payments and that kind of stuff. And then we convert that into a more direct cash flow method like we would need for float. So we add VAT to the sales numbers. We look at what's the profile of how those invoices are paid. So do we get paid on the first week of the month, the last week of the month? And then we upload that into float to then produce as a daily, weekly cash flow forecast that, because we've produced it for 12 months, it's there for 12 months, but we're looking in detail at the next 13. That's the kind of accepted norm and a sensible period of time that you should be expecting an accurate forecast. And the way that float works is, you know, 4 to 6 weeks is super accurate because you've got all your invoices and bills that it's pulling straight from your accounting system. And then beyond that, there's some budgets and forecasts that we've built in.
Okay, very good. All right, so enough pumping float up. Let's get back to you. So tell me a bit, you know, one of the interesting things, you mentioned you've got this MBO experience, and I'm interested in MBOs personally, actually. I think it's a very, you know, only 20% of businesses that go to exit, quote unquote, actually manage to do it. It's actually a lot less than you might think reading the FT or whatever you're reading, or even TechCrunch or any other things. Most companies, let's be honest, fizzle and die by the sounds of it, inauspiciously. But MBO seems to me to be sort of the dream outcome, if you like. You know, you don't have to deal with any risky third party like, you know, private equity or anyone else. Nothing wrong with private equity, even strategic or anyone else at all, let's face it. You're in control of it. If you can manage it within the people you already know, the team you already trust and like and hopefully want to get on with, it's that's kind of the dream exit for me. If everyone can get wanted it, something out of it, I think, for a lot of people, you know. So you managed to, you've worked with a number of clients on this front. I mean, you've been talking about one in particular, which is, you know, there were two partners. One was thinking about retiring, which I guess is, again, is a super common setup. Tell us a bit about, this client. What did they want to achieve and what options did you look at for helping them achieve that?
Yeah, okay. So yeah, this was a client, as you say, that was two main partners, one thinking about retiring, and we were just trying to work through the various scenarios of how to make that happen. Obviously, the business had a value, which we needed to try and work out. And then how do we effectively fund the purchase of the shares from the retiring shareholder to then bring that equity back into the business and then move on? So, I mean, there's two main options for that, kind of what we came to, which was, do we get private equity investment? And effectively, the equity from the retiring shareholder is taken by a private equity firm and they fund the majority of it. Or the option that you could go for and that we decided to go for was to fund it ourselves effectively. So borrow some money, look at timescale and what our cash generation was looking at, and effectively build up those cash reserves added to the amount that we borrowed to be able to buy out that shareholder at the right time that made sense. We had to work on a valuation to work out that they were getting fair value for it. So we'd had a couple of interested parties, that private equity firm, so that kind of gave us a market value for the business that we could then work out a deal between the partners that would make sense. Yeah, and then started to work on how we could make that happen.
Okay, so the valuation is the first piece, right? So it's kind of hard to figure out what exactly it's worth. Did you solicit these valuations, or had they just come in over the years and, you know, you had a rough idea set up?
Yeah, I think the CEO of the business is a really good guy, knows his stuff, and was having conversations with private equity just to kind of see what options were there in the future. So yeah, they were semi-solicited, I suppose you would say. So they were having an interesting conversation, and a letter of intent had come across and gone, okay, if we were to do something, this is what it would look like. And they had two conversations, both which came in at around a similar sort of number, which gave us a good benchmark to go with.
Okay, and something that was the first thing to get out of the way. And then how did you, in terms of time frame, from the start of these conversations to the end of the, situation, or maybe there was some sort of earnout, or tell us about from soup to nuts, how long did it take to put the whole thing together?
So, yeah, start to finish, probably 18 months. Didn't want to rush at it. We wanted to make sure we had sensible kind of debt levels and cash levels built up to be able to do the deal. And the business has good recurring revenue, so we can kind of predict where things were going. They were growing really nicely. So we used a financial model, obviously. So we built that model, built all the forecasts in, predicted where we were going to get to. As we got closer to it, we were then using float to check where our cash balance was going to get to. And not just to the point of doing the deal, but then doing the deal and knowing we were going to be okay post-deal once we'd done that buyout.
And you're all making it sound very rosy so far. What were the sticking points? Like, what was the hardest thing about putting this together? Or was it as easy as you're making it sound?
It's always easy afterwards when it's all gone fine. Nah, it was a friendly deal, which was good. Everybody kind of knew what they wanted out of it, and there wasn't really too much arm wrestling involved in the middle of it. There was some corporate structuring and kind of making sure we had, doing this kind of deal, we had to make sure we had the right P&L reserves to be able to buy back the shares into the company. There was a bit of corporate structuring to put a top co over the top and that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's all doable. You get the right advice, then I think that works well.
So the top co here in Ireland, the reason people do that is there's, you know, you can, there's various reliefs and tax efficiencies by having a top co and allows you to go and do something else with it. In the UK, what was the reasoning behind restructuring like that?
That was just all about making sure we could get the shareholdings structured correctly, and that effectively the top co could buy the shares from each of the shareholders, including the exiting shareholder. So then, the top co effectively bought the trading entity.
Oh, interesting. So instead of just selling the shares and the company acquiring them, there's a new company that top co was the one that raised the debt. Is that how it worked?
It actually wasn't, but we managed to get the reserves from the trading companies up into the top co, so the top co had the reserves to be able to buy back the shares.
And how was that done without creating a tax bill, or because how did you manage the tax in that, from money going from one company to the other?
Again, getting the right advice from the tax advisors, but effectively we were dividending up through the structure, which is intercompany, so it didn't generate any tax.
Okay, very good. In the you didn't create the debt in the end. You were able to do it from cash, I like. So did that make the partner who was exiting the business maybe feel like he could have got a bit more? Because it sounds like it was just done from cash, and if he'd stayed in the business, he'd have half of that cash anyway.
No, I think the fact that we'd agreed a deal that everybody was happy with at the outset, we knew where we were going and we knew how we were going to get there. It was all everybody's happy.
Okay. So after the whole thing went through, you were particularly happy, I believe. So which is that we alluded at the top of the show how, you know, you're selling hours and time, but you want to be able to build equity for yourself. So what happened at the end of that deal? Because I understand that you were offered a position in the business. Is that correct or no?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm quite open about this. Yeah, I invested in the business at the time of the MBO. I really like the business. I get on really well, work really well with the CEO and the team there. And yeah, in terms of them wanting me to still be around in the business longer term, still as a fractional CFO, but effectively having a vested interest in the business. So yeah, I'm now a shareholder in that business as well.
Very good. And I mean, this is kind of a superpower that finance team members often have, is that they get sort of an opportunity to become equity holders, you know, where no one else in the company may not be aware of it, right? This is kind of the superpower. I know of a family, or he was a CFO for a dog food company in South Africa. And, you know, the dog food company wasn't going very well, but he was a CFO. He saw the opportunity. He was able to buy the whole thing and then went on to be, you know, he's flying around the place in a private jet. So that's the superpower of a CFO. Does it bring any conflict, you know, in owning, being a member, owning part of the company? Do you think it brings any conflict when it comes to dealing with that client? Do you ever feel like, well, hold on, I own part of this too, you know, or maybe does it change the way you feel about working for that client?
No, not really. I mean, depends. I guess the way I work personally is that you give everything into everybody you work with anyway. I think what it does do, it means that I'm still a fractional CFO with them. I effectively freelance, but I am more tied to them longer term, and my interests are aligned from a long term perspective. So yeah, it's one of those things. Having kind of had equity in the past in private equity deals and things, my personal view is you put that to one side. You park that, and it's a bonus if something happens in the future with that. I think you deliver the best you can for everybody.
Very good. All right. So maybe we could wrap it up a little bit. Maybe you can just tell us, you know, who should get in touch with you, and how can they do it, Andy?
Yeah, sure. So you can look me up on LinkedIn, obviously, Andy Mellor, or go to the website, summit17.co.uk.
Great. All right. Very nice logo. People recommend people go and have a look at it. It's got quite an engineering theme going on there, which is good. Works well in the summit. Thanks very much. And thank you for listening. If you've been listening this far, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Now, I know what you're thinking. Why the hell would I want to sign up for James's newsletter? Well, let me tell you. We had our newsletter. We were putting it out. You know, we put the podcast in there so, you know, everyone can see the podcast start releasing. That was fine. We were getting a 20% open rate. And we decided to go, what's the British equivalent? So we decided to go full Sun newspaper on the thing. We started to look for juicier headlines. So what recently we've been doing is we've been putting in examples of waste, fraud and abuse found in the press over the last week from municipalities, small businesses, some NGOs are in there. And we started putting these in as celebratory tales, if you like, about how not to run your business so that we can all learn from them. And at the same time, let's face it, it's fun as well. So we've had some supermodels in there. We've had municipalities, Croydon Municipality and County Council in the UK got in there. And there's a range of different odds and sods of businesses who've made financial mistakes and now have ended up in the press. So for no other reason other than to maybe learn a thing or two about what not to do with your finances and learn how Procurement Express can help you avoid ending up in our newsletter in the first place, you can now sign it up at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. And that's my outro. Thanks, Andy. This was a good chat and I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for coming along.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it.